Good morning. Good morning to all of those who join us via camera. Hope you guys had a good Thanksgiving, and all of you. So, in the 1980s, Kaiser Permanente had an obesity clinic in San Diego that was, by all accounts, mostly very successful. The vast majority of people in this program, which is a very good program, lost weight in a healthy way following the guidelines of the program that the doctors had given them. However, something strange was happening that this pattern started to emerge that the doctors were started to worry about. About 50% of those who entered the program who were successful in the program would drop out after a short amount of time, despite their success. So they entered the program, and by all accounts, they really wanted to lose weight. They wanted this stuff to work. It was working, but something changed in them. Something stopped them from being able to finish this program. So instead of just attributing this to merely the willpower of the dropouts, the head of the program, Dr. Vincent Folletti, started to do exit interviews to find these people specifically and what was going on with them and to find out the patterns. And the patterns he began to see surprised him. He discovered that over half of the 286 dropouts had experienced some sort of childhood abuse. Kaiser saw all of this and the childhood trauma, and they commissioned a study to look at the effects of trauma, and especially childhood trauma, on people. They devised a 10-question survey called the ACE, including such questions, just as an example of the type of questions that they would use is, before the age of 18, did your parent or another adult in your household act in a way that made you afraid that you might be physically hurt? Did you often not have enough to eat, wear dirty clothes, or felt like you had no one to protect you? Questions like this. There's 10 questions on the quiz. And the correlation that they found, this is a giant, over 17,000 people took this survey, which is a huge sample size. And the correlation between the ACE scores and the medical conditions were frightening. Patients with an ACE score of 3 were 500% more likely to be an alcoholic than those with an ACE score of 0. Patients with an ACE score of 4, which means they answered yes to 4 of those questions I mentioned, were 3 times as likely to be on an antidepressant. And perhaps most chillingly, people with an ACE score of 6 or higher had an average decrease in life expectancy of over 20 years. I bring this up because we've been thinking about healing lately, and healing comes in a lot of different forms. And I think we all know that healing is very needed. And we all believe in the power of prayer. And I think with all of the things that have happened within our church and even within our state lately, we can see a beautiful outpouring of love to those who face crisis. And how generous people are. And I think that's a really great thing to see. But it also made me think of some of those wounds that are just as damaging, but can't be seen. So I wanted to look at what are those wounds. And God is a healing God, and we all know that. And he heals those outer wounds. He heals blindness and lameness just as he heals the stuff inside of us. So I wanted to take a look at, in the Bible, how does he heal that? What is that process? So given that definition of trauma in the ACE test, at first it was difficult for me because I wanted to find a case study, something in the Bible that we could correlate. We could look at this and see how these conditions affected someone in the Bible and how God worked in their life. And at first it was kind of difficult. I was like, how do I find childhood trauma? What am I going to do? But as I looked through, I realized the answer was staring me straight in the face. So this person I found, listen to how many criteria from the ACE test he fits. When he was a child, adult members of his household humiliated and insulted him. These adult members almost certainly acted in a way and probably followed through with threats of physical abuse. He probably, during his childhood, he had a family that might have felt like it didn't look out or support each other. He lost a close member of his family at a young age, and he experienced a deep betrayal of family members he trusted. Do you guys recognize who this person might be? Because it's such a classic Sunday school story, I've often looked at the story of Joseph, I think, through too simplistic of a lens, at least for me. I would look at it and it made sense. You know, I saw the story of Joseph and all he had to go through, and specifically the end of the story. And I would look at it and they're like, okay, Joseph is trying to kind of test his brothers. But I was thinking, if Joseph is trying to save his brothers, why this very complex kind of charade he goes through? You know, wasn't there a quicker way of doing it, or couldn't he be done it in a different way? If he's trying to save the relationship, was that really the best way to do it? I mean, it works out, but like, why does he need to kind of do it over this course of 2 or 3 years, over several times, and lying about some stuff and hiding other stuff? Why does he go through all of this? So, like I said, it's a long story, so I want to pick it up at the end. Joseph already has been left to die and sold into slavery by his envious brothers at the point where we're picking up. He's already been betrayed yet again by an otherwise benevolent master, due to the devious machinations of his wife. He's already been bruised by shackles and spent years in jail, and then through the power of the gift of God's wisdom, risen all the way from that place to being the second in command of Egypt. And he's been prudently storing that food up for a coming famine. He has a home. He's got a position. He's got a young family. He's got a wife and two children. And he finally, for once in his life, is in a place of peace and security. And he's surrounded by people who love him and respect him. He is in a place where he's okay. He must have been so thankful that God had blessed him enough to take him out of all of that pain that was in the past and bring him to a place where he's got all of these things that he always wanted, but, you know, he wasn't able to have. And then one day, you know, he must have just been an ordinary day. He's doing his job, he's with his family, and then all of a sudden, he's got a knock on the door, metaphorically. And then there are these monsters at his door he probably might have thought he'd never see again. Or at least he hadn't thought of in a very long time. Can you imagine what Joseph was thinking about at that moment? He certainly wouldn't have known his brothers were going to come on that day. It's something that we can all relate to. Even if it's not intense childhood drama or getting thrown in jail by your brothers like Joseph, it can be anything. The loss of a loved one, or even a breakup, or even the estrangement of a friend can be traumatic of events for us. Sometimes, just like those monsters at Joseph's door, those things come knocking when you least expect it. Something comes back in our life and we're like, whoa, where did that come from? And they're not always massive. Sometimes you just take a deep breath and you're like, I'm okay. Everything's fine. And you move on. But sometimes for the big things, for stuff like what happened to Joseph, it can feel like that you're that same person. Like however long in the past that was, however long ago, that you never really left that person behind or those events behind. And that can be kind of scary. It can feel like something's chasing you and you think you've gotten away from it. Joseph probably thought he got away from it, but then here it is back in his face. I mean, just look at Joseph. As far away as he's gotten and as high as he's risen, it's still with him. Because really, it's never gone away. Those monsters, those problems in his past really can't go away because they're inside of Joseph. They live inside of him. They're not just external. And I think this is what Joseph's feeling. He would have been scared. He would have had some problems with feeling these things. But objectively speaking, what do Joseph's brothers look like at this point? To Joseph, they probably do look like monsters. He hasn't seen in a long time. But what did they actually look like? They're lowly herdsmen, right? In front of the second in command of all of Egypt. They've just arrived from a long journey. They're weary. They're tired. They're dirty. They're desperate for food. They're probably hungry and starving. That's why they've had to come this far in the first place. They're requesting food from a man that they know could end their lives at the snap of a finger. So they're pretty scared too. Objectively speaking, they're not a threat at all to Joseph. It doesn't matter what happened in the past. They cannot harm Joseph in the least. To a man of Joseph's stature, they would have looked, in a word, pathetic. Reading from Genesis 42, 7 through 12. This is the scene. As soon as Joseph saw his brothers, he recognized them, but he pretended to be a stranger, and he spoke harshly to them. "Where did you come from?" he asked. From the land of Canaan, they replied, to buy food. Although Joseph recognized his brothers, they did not recognize him. Then he remembered his dream about them and said to them, you are spies. You have come to see why our land is unprotected. No, my lord, they answered, your servants have come to buy food. We are all the sons of one man. Your servants are honest men, not spies. No, he said to them, you have come to see this land is unprotected. Who's more scared here? Of course the brothers are terrified, and I won't argue with that. But again, the brothers are not a threat to them. They're not a threat to Joseph. But look how Joseph reacts. He's instinctive. He's angry. He's defensive. He's aggressive. He speaks to them harshly. He accuses them of being spies. Notice a couple things. First of all, it states that Joseph remembered his dreams. He remembered the dreams about his brothers bowing down to him. To remember something implies you forgot something. I don't think necessarily that Joseph totally forgot about the dreams, that it was never in his mind, but I think more likely Joseph pushed it down. Joseph didn't want to think about that stuff from the past. He didn't want to think about those dreams. When things hurt us, we don't like to think about it, right? That's just human nature. We like to put it in a box labeled the past and stuff it as far up in the attic as possible. But that's not what God wants for Joseph. God brings that box down from the attic and puts it right in his face. It's also not a coincidence. The other thing, just a slight thing to notice, he ties up Simeon. Simeon, we know from other parts of the Bible, is one of his most violent and angry and aggressive brothers. Simeon, along with his brother Levi, goes and slaughters a whole town of people for an offense to their family. Tying someone up and throwing them in jail is a brutal act. Joseph would know that. So he is acting angrily. You know, there is something in him that is acting aggressively towards his brothers, and certainly towards Simeon. I don't know if Simeon had more to do with tying Joseph up, but I don't think it's a coincidence he chooses Simeon of all his brothers to throw in jail. Joseph's reaction, this anger, this aggressiveness, is interesting because that pain and grief from so long ago, you can see it rising to the surface. I'm sure Joseph did not act like this on a daily basis, being second in command of Egypt. Nothing about Joseph indicates that this is Joseph's character. The reason for all those grim statistics about the A scores earlier is that when trauma and pain and hurt rears its head, we can sometimes become our worst self. We try to self-medicate with things that hurt us, destroy healthy relationships just to have a sliver of control over the mistaken belief that that relationship is going to wither away anyway. We retreat into ourselves and into depression when we start to believe that those monsters is something that will never go away through our whole life. Like God bringing the brothers to Egypt, I think often on purpose, God brings us face to face with those things from our past. On purpose. We see it in the Bible as God bringing us to the fears. Sometimes, like in the Bible, it makes it very metaphorical. We see a giant or we see a raging sea. But I would suspect that there's some sort of monster knocking at most of your doors, whether it's a big monster or a small monster, something there. Because over and over, and God does this on purpose because we see that God proves himself to us. God shows he's there with us because he takes that darkness and takes that hurt and those challenges and turns it to light. God takes the things and the people in our life that everyone else has given up on. Look at the lepers and the blind and the deaf and relationships in the Bible and whole nations and even the dead, things that cannot be restored. And he brings it back to life. And I think a broken spirit is every bit as much of a miracle when it is healed. Remember when the lame man in the New Testament was lowered through the roof to Jesus? What does Jesus say first? It's not get up and walk. Because what's the greatest miracle? The greatest miracle is Jesus saying, take heart, son, your sins are forgiven. That past is washed away. Because the monster at that man's door was not his legs. It was not the lameness. It was some hurt, some sin in his heart that he thought would follow him for the rest of his life. But now he's free. And I think that's that process we are seeing in the story of Joseph. So picking up on the story again, Joseph puts Simeon in jail, sends the brothers away under the condition they're not to come back unless they bring Benjamin. The journey from Hebron to Egypt's 250 miles. It's a long way. It's not easy to walk. And there's a wait period in between where the family again has to starve enough to the point where they're willing to send Benjamin. So we're talking about a long time, probably years. And I think it's kind of nice because just a small note, I think God is giving Joseph some time to heal here. God's giving Joseph that time. We all need time to process things. And I think in some ways, this is what God is giving to Joseph in this time, breathing room. Now reading from Genesis 43. Joseph's brothers return with Benjamin in tow, finally years later, from Genesis 43. When Joseph came home, they presented to him gifts they had brought into the house, and they bowed down before him to the ground. He asked them how they were, and he said, "How was your aged father you told me about? Is he still living?" They replied, "Your servant, our father, is alive and well." And they bowed, prostrating themselves before him. And they looked about, and then they saw his brother Benjamin, his own mother's son. And he asked, "Is this your youngest brother, the one you told me about?" And he said, "God be gracious to you, my son." Deeply moved at the sight of his brother, Joseph hurried out and looked for a place to weep. He went to a private room and wept there. After he had washed his face, he came out and, controlling himself, said, "Serve the food." Joseph is moved to compassion. In fact, he can barely stand it without weeping. But for now, at this point in the story, Joseph's compassion and sorrow are for those things he loved, which he missed dearly, his younger brother and his father. He can start to look back at the past, and it's a slow process, and he can see those things that he did love, that God gave him in his past that he loved. And even just accepting that is a big step for Joseph. At the same time, the anger is still in his heart, though. He can accept the good, but I think it's a somewhat passive-aggressive move, sitting them in age order, because he knows his brothers don't know who he is, but he's saying, "I know who you are." He's trying to scare them, and they are scared. It says the brothers kind of whisper around, like, "What's going on here?" I think Joseph did that. Joseph's a smart guy. He does that on purpose. He did it to make his brothers feel uneasy and on edge. And it's at this point that Joseph arranges the confrontation. He wants to force his brothers out into the open. He does something that's, frankly, made them fear for their lives, the lives of their family. It's almost a bit mean. Interestingly, though, I think modern psychology predicts this is exactly what someone who has experienced previous childhood trauma would do. Psychiatrist Dr. Bruce Perry is considered one of the leaders in his field in childhood trauma. And he writes a book called The Boy Who Was Raised About a Dog, and he tells a story about a little girl who went through some really extreme trauma. At the age of 3, she saw the loss of her mother through violent means. So he was assigned to talk to this girl, and for many, many months, Dr. Perry saw this girl, and she wouldn't say anything. She would just sit there, draw, but not say a word to him. But finally, what she started to do is curl him up in the same exact position that her mother was in. And she would start to reenact the events of what happened. And Dr. Perry didn't say anything. He just let her have control of the situation. And she would change something a little bit every time when she did it. Like, at first it was exactly like what happened, but then she would change little parts of the event until at the very end, she started to talk to Dr. Perry and she wanted him to respond. In other words, she changed the scenario into something that was good. She changed the memory in a way. She was able to control it. The conclusion Dr. Perry came to about trauma was this, that all of us have a need to feel safe and secure and have power. But sometimes when we experience things like this, whether we're a child or not, it shatters that feeling of security, of power over our situation. What the girl was doing without knowing it consciously was taking just a bit of that control back. She was able to take the situation and replay it and be able to look back and accept what happened. If you look at it, this is close to what Joseph does. He finds a way to recreate the scenario of his youth, Joseph gets his brothers, he accuses Benjamin of doing something wrong, and he sets it up perfectly. He gives his brothers the opportunity to betray their brother one more time. But in this case, of course, Joseph has control of the situation. Joseph is in charge. Joseph is the powerful one. And I don't know this. I can't possibly know this. But I wouldn't be surprised if, despite the evidence Joseph's got so far, his brothers acting nicer, his brother's demeanor and actions, Joseph might still somewhere in his heart have expected his brothers to fail this test. So Joseph takes Benjamin, accusing him falsely, and when the brothers are presented before Joseph, something unexpected happens. Judah stands and gives a speech that shows not a man who's dangerous or a monster or callous or mean, but who's just scared and confused. And most of all, will do anything, even give his own life, not to repeat the same mistake that had happened so many years before. I don't think this is what Joseph was expecting. For the first time, Joseph can clearly see that he was not in control. Perhaps that Judah was not in control either. It was not Joseph's expectations that were met, it was God's. This is the moment where Joseph is finally able to accept, and we can see this in the story. Accept his brothers, accept that they're not the same jealous and angry men that they were before, and that Joseph is not the same scared and hurt teenager. And accept most of all, God's part in all of this. Look at what Joseph says. Do not be distressed and do not be angry with yourselves for selling me here, because it was to save lives that God sent me ahead of you. For 2 years now, there has been famine in the land. And for the next 5 years, there will be no plowing and reaping. But God sent me ahead of you to preserve you for a remnant on earth and to save your lives by a great deliverance. So then it was not you who sent me here, but God. He made me father to Pharaoh, lord of the entire household and ruler of all Egypt. So this is what I realize I have got wrong since Sunday school. This story is not about Joseph saving his brothers. The story is about God saving Joseph. His brothers have already changed. They've changed since the very beginning of what we talked about today. They've already been carrying this guilt around for more than a decade, and it lives with them in their hearts. This story is not just about a broken relationship between brothers that needs to be healed, but about a man with something broken in himself that needs to be healed. Joseph was a good man, but I think he struggled to reconcile his past with his current self, his goodness and kindness and belief in a good God with what had happened to him. Even for a man like Joseph, who is a good, godly man, the question of why did this happen to me can be a haunting one. How could someone who's so close to me do this? People blame the environment or bad luck or themselves or others of why bad things happen. But Joseph does have it answered. He gets this question, why did it happen, answer. In his own words, Joseph says, so then it was not you, it was not the brothers who sent me here, but God. He made me father to Pharaoh, lord of his entire household and ruler of all Egypt. The healing finally comes to Joseph when he realized that it was not his brothers that had sent him away to Egypt or caused all of these things to happen in his life, but it was God. There had been so many trials and tribulations Joseph had faced through his life where he needed to trust God, and he had been through a jail and in front of the ruler of Egypt, but the greatest trial to Joseph's faith was to see these brothers. He struggles with this more than any other challenge. When we feel deeply hurt and betrayed, it's not just other people we have trouble trusting. It can also be God. I know it's something I can struggle with sometimes. I mean, yeah, it's easy to trust God when things are good. But when those monsters are knocking at the door, when we're remembering those things, that's tough. The acceptance that God is in control, I find, is easier said than done. We all want to do it. We all say, yeah, God's in control. But to actually feel that, that's something entirely different. Because to do that, to be able to say God's in control, that means you're not just accepting he's in control now when you're okay, and he's not just in control when things are good, But he was in control in the back then too. He was in control when things hurt and when things were hard and when you felt lost and lonely and betrayed. But the moment you can accept that is when healing begins. Because to truly accept that, to accept that God is and was and always will be in control of your life, that puts your life totally and completely at the mercy of God. And sometimes quickly and sometimes slowly, but always, always, if you put your hands in the life of God and you give your life and put it at the mercy of God, that healing will come. Because he's a good God and he's a just God and he is a healing God. And as we move to take the bread and wine this morning, just take another second to consider another good man who struggled with putting his life into the hands of God, into the will of God. A man who was able to do it completely and totally, but did find it hard. Consider that he gave his life to the will of God more completely than any other that has ever lived, so that we may struggle and sometimes make mistakes on our way to the goodness and mercy of God and to that healing. Consider that through that man, we are promised a new world without tears or mourning or pain, that we may live in closeness to him and to his Father forevermore.